where I live.
Intruder alert, intruder alert.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars. Play Astro Blaster.
R2 joint increase the power.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and for this show, I'll be talking about Cinematronic's smash arcade hit from 1983, Dragon's Lair. Now, before I jump into the history and other interesting tidbits of Dragon's Lair, I'd like to first talk about my own history with the game. Like many of the titles I'll be talking about on the podcast, this was one of the games I first played at that fabled Showbiz Pizza of my youth. Showbiz, though, was not where I was first introduced to Dragon's Lair. Thanks to the early gaming magazines of the 1980s, like Joystick, I had seen a picture here and there talking about this whole new type of arcade game, one that certainly looked to me to be 100% animated. Then came that afternoon when, after school, I turned on the TV to watch the latest episode of TBS's arcade game show, Starcade.
This is Starcade, TV's first video arcade game show. And today's show is special. We have only one game on the show today, Dragon's Lair. And it's the first game of a brand new video game technology. The Dragon's Lair adventure begins in an enchanted castle in a far distant time. And Dirth the Daring is on a quest to rescue the fair Princess Daphne, held captive by a fierce dragon.
My 11-year-old mind was totally blown by what I saw on that special episode of Starcade. I was immediately captivated by the bumbling but quite heroic Dirk the Daring, the beautiful Princess Daphne, and of course, the equally beautiful animation provided by Don Bluth and his animation studio, the Bluth Group. Every waking moment for the next 2 months was spent fantasizing about what it would be like to play the game. My schoolwork was filled with doodles of Dirk the Daring, sometimes jumping paragraph to paragraph. I'm not making that up, by the way. It got so bad that my teacher actually bought me a sketchbook to keep my worksheets clear. Of course, I was constantly holding my breath every single time we pulled into the parking lot of Showbiz Pizza. Would this be the day that I walked in through the entrance and see the Dragon's Lair cabinet? After a couple of months, it came to be. The front doors allowed you to see into the arcade, and there it was, with a large line of people in single file waiting their turn to play. They had a monitor set atop the cabinet, so the group behind the current player could be entertained by watching their attempt at getting Dirk to the Dragon's Lair. It truly was a magical day, and although my time with the game was incredibly brief, and that was even with the help of another player giving advice, I felt my then unheard of 50 cents a play was well spent. And when I left Showbiz that afternoon, I was walking on cloud nine. Soon after that, I would grab any magazine or newspaper that mentioned Dragon's Lair. I even started a scrapbook. A little bit of that book I shared on the Retroist last July. I'll be sure to include a link on the podcast post. And whether on the playground or at home, I would reenact scenes from the game to the best of my ability, including having my father tie small lengths of rope to the lower limbs of the giant tree in our front yard, so I could pretend to be swinging over the fire pits like in the game. This bit of fun almost turned fatal for me. One weekend, while playing around the tree, I was showing how high I could swing to a visiting school friend, and in a million-to-one occurrence, the rope caught around my neck. So when I let it go, it cinched tight and started strangling me. I was literally hanging by my neck from the tree branch, being choked to death. Thankfully, my school friend shot off like a rocket and brought my father back in tow, who quickly lifted me up and severed the rope. Obviously, the rest of the ropes were cut down immediately after. Now, on that harrowing memory, let's switch gears and talk a little about the talent and company that helped to bring the legendary game to life. Cinematronics got its start in 1975, when it was founded by Jim Puris, Dennis Partey, and Gary Garrison. The company hit it big in 1977, when they released the vector graphics classic Space Wars and Starhawk. Their biggest hits were mostly vector graphic titles, such as 1979's Tail Gunner and Sundance, followed in 1980 by Star Castle, which is a game I can't wait to talk about in a future show. Also in 1980, they released Rip Off in Armor Attack. In 1982, they had War of the Worlds, Naughty Boy, and Jack the Giant Killer. Those last two were not vector graphics games. It was also in 1982 that Cinematronics found itself having to file for Chapter 11, and this is when the company had the good fortune of crossing paths with Rick Dyer and Don Bluth. Rick Dyer impressed toy company Mattel when in college, when he developed an electronic horse racing game. He was hired straight out of school and helped to design some of the company's handheld electronic games, as well as working on the Intellivision. Before he went over to Coleco to help design not just their handheld ports of popular arcade games like Defender and Donkey Kong, but he worked on the ColecoVision as well. Dyer ended up forming his own company called Advanced Microcomputer Systems, experimenting with what he could accomplish with interactive movies. He soon came to realize that his best bet was with the then burgeoning Laserdisc technology. Using inspiration from the likes of The Lord of the Rings, as well as William Crowther's text-based Colossal Cave Adventure, he created the concept for Shadowen, what he intended his Laserdisc arcade game to be called. It was after seeing 1982's The Secret of NIMH that Dyer approached the Bluth Group to secure their talents for his new game. Don Bluth was already a legend in the field of animation at this point in his career, having worked on 1973's Robin Hood, 1977's The Rescuers, and Pete's Dragon. In 1975, Bluth was becoming discouraged in what he saw as the Disney studio turning their back on the traditional animation style. So he and his friends Gary Goldman and John Pomeroy would get together in his garage to work on a short called Banjo the Woodpile Cat. 4 years later, Bluth, thanks to his work on the short, was able to get financing for what would become The Secret of NIMH. 3 years later, the animated classic would be released in theaters. But, do you remember the name of the little movie that was dominating the box office in 1982? The Secret of NIMH had the sad misfortune of debuting 3 weeks after E.T. the Extraterrestrial was released, and the Spielberg juggernaut sadly overshadowed the animated film. With a budget of $7 million, The Secret of NIMH earned a total of $14,665,773 in its American run, which to the studio was considered a failure. Don Bluth now found himself without financing for his next feature film, which is when Rick Dyer approached him about providing the animation for his Laserdisc game. Dyer had a small problem, though, in that he couldn't afford to spend the money that Bluth would normally charge. So the two were able to come to an agreement where Bluth would own one-third interest in a new gaming company called Starcom, with Dyer also taking one-third interest and Cinematronics getting the last third after agreeing to manufacture as well as take on the responsibility of marketing the game. Even with the new Laserdisc technology, the group realized that Shadowen was just too big of a story and decided to focus on a smaller part of its epic tale. It was head writer Victor Penman, with Marty Folger and Darlene Waddington, that came up with a story that would become Dragon's Lair, using a location that was mentioned in Dyer's Shadowen. Taking 6 months to complete 27 minutes of animation, the Bluth group with a staff of 70 animators certainly delivered, nearly filling the then 30 minutes provided on a one-sided Laserdisc. It's been said that the cost of that animation came to $1.3 million alone, and even that was accomplished by cutting quarters in regards to the voice actors. Don Bluth had his assistant editor, Dan Molina, voice the cries of pain and fear of Dirk the Daring, with the seductive voice of Princess Daphne being provided by cleanup animator Vera Lamfer. Although Michael Rye, who provided his vocal talent during the Attract screen, was certainly a professional actor, as he got his start in the golden age of radio. And what an Attract mode it was.
Dragon's Lair, a fantasy adventure where you become a valiant knight on a quest to rescue the fair princess from the clutches of an evil dragon. You control the actions of a daring adventurer finding his way through the castle of a dark wizard who has enchanted it with treacherous monsters and obstacles. In the mysterious caverns below the castle, your odyssey continues against the awesome forces that oppose your efforts to reach the dragon's lair. Lead on, adventurer. Your quest awaits.
Even to this day, when hearing that Attract mode, I'm ready to grab my 50 cents and do my best to get Dirk to the dragon's lair. Now, I said there was 27 minutes of animation, but if a skilled player is able to play Dragon's Lair from beginning to end without making a mistake, it only takes 6 minutes in total. That 27 minutes included, of course, all of Dirk the Daring's various death scenes for wrong moves while braving the Dragon's Lair. In 1983, when a prototype of the game was presented at the Amusement Operators Expo, it generated a large amount of hope for the visiting arcade owners. Remember, back in 83, the video game crash was in effect, and even the arcades were feeling the bite. But when Dragon's Lair was released to arcades on July 1st, though sadly that wasn't true in my neck of the woods, it was quite simply a smash hit. It's been reported that a typical popular arcade game during that time might make $100 a week, but Dragon's Lair was pulling in $1,400 a week. In the first 8 months of producing the arcade game, it earned $32 million in sales for Starcom, with Cinematronics really having to work hard to meet demands for machines across the country. It certainly looked like everyone was experiencing the same Dragon's Lair fever that I was. Besides that special episode of Starcade, the game was featured on an episode of That's Incredible, and was naturally being talked about on numerous local news reports.
The familiar din of the video arcade is fading out. Business has dropped in half over the past year, and companies like Atari claim losses of more than $350 million. The slick, swift-paced space games are taking a nosedive, and analysts predict a crunch in the industry by Christmas. The craze has definitely peaked.
But there is something completely different that's invading the video emporium these days, and it's a result of the recent marriage between the laser and computer technology. It's pretty amazing to see. So, if your game, let's coin up.
Enter the world of the Dragon's Lair. It's big news at most arcades these days because of its unique action. The screen transforms into another dimension, and the player controls the fate of a real character whose quest is to slay the dragon.
It's too hard.
Oh, I think it's about the best game I've ever played.
It took me at least $40 before, you know, I killed the dragon.
One thing about these new games, they're a bit more expensive than the regular arcade games. These cost 50 cents to play, and Dave here is going to stand behind me and help me in case I make a mistake.
Now, to be fair, even for all the heaps of praise the game was receiving, there were some players then, as well as now, who had issues with the gameplay. Since, when you really get down to it, there is no real freedom of choice. You are playing an interactive movie. By 1984, the shine of Laserdisc technology had mostly worn off, even with the release of the science fiction-themed Space Ace. Part of that was due to the issues with the Laserdisc player technology of the time. The game was quite often down for repair, not helped at all by the sometimes rough handling of the machines by angry players. It's been reported that the original Laserdisc players, within the cabinets, were designed to last a mere 650 hours. But thankfully could be upgraded to sturdier players that could be counted on for at least 50,000 hours. The Laserdiscs themselves were truly one-sided, at least the 1983 version, with the back side of the disc given a metal backing to help strengthen it and reduce the chance of snapping the disc. As for the gameplay itself, Dragon's Lair tasks 1-2 players, by taking turns, with using a sword button and a joystick to enter a correct move at certain key moments. If done correctly, you're rewarded with progressing to the next scene. A wrong move earns you a generally humorous death scene for Dirk and a loss of one of your lives. The game offers help as well with a quick flash of light sometimes, highlighting the direction you should take. Although there is certainly two rooms I can think of where this is actually a trap. Although there are 29 different rooms in the castle, 8 of those rooms are called mirror versions. In an effort to save on animation costs and time, they are simply reversed versions of the scenes. So, in the rope room where Dirk must swing across the fire pits in one room, you start on the right-hand side of the screen. In the mirrored version, you start on the left. The rooms that Dirk must brave in the game are, besides the ropes, the bedroom, where a knight must jump through a rapidly closing hole in a wall, flying barding, and its mirrored room, where Dirk must hang tight to enchanted flying horse armor, the wizard's kitchen with its tempting potions, the Crypt Keeps, which also offers a mirrored version, which finds Dirk contending with snapping skulls, enormous skeletal hands, and deadly black ooze, plus the Crypt Creeps themselves. The Underground River. Dirk takes to the water and must navigate treacherous hazards like whirlpools and rapids. The Elevator. There are actually 3 versions of this screen. Once Dirk hops on the wooden platform, he is sent hurtling down to his certain doom unless he manages to successfully leap to safety. One screen offers you 3 chances to escape, with the other 2 screens offering 9 chances. One is also a mirrored version. The crumbling ceiling. After Dirk's helmet is knocked down around his ears, he must escape the room before he's buried alive. The boulder trench forces Dirk to keep one step ahead of a massive black boulder, or giant marble, as well as making sure to avoid being crushed by the various colored boulders in front of him. 3 caves challenges our hero to escape an electrified cage and floor, as well as time his passing over a bridge with an erupting geyser of lava. The Black Knight on horseback. In this room, thanks to a bit of magical energy, Dirk is unable to free his sword, which is bad timing with the arrival of the Black Knight and his dark steed. Our hero must flee for his life from his opponent. But don't worry, Dirk and the Black Knight will meet again a little later in the game. In the Grim Reaper room, our hero is forced to time his jumps between 2 spinning traps. Once safely through, he must face the Reaper itself. This room also has a mirrored version. Then, there is one of my favorite rooms in the game, the Lizard King. Dirk loses his sword to a magical pot of gold, and is forced to give chase, all the while avoiding getting his head caved in by the Lizard King, who's following close behind, swinging his scepter. The Forge, or it's sometimes called the Smithy. Dirk must avoid deadly enchanted weapons as well as the stone smithy itself. This room, too, has a mirror version. The Breathing Door. Dirk finds himself swept forward by a continuous gust of wind, giving him only a split-second chance of escape. The Tentacle Room finds our hero confronted by grasping tentacles. Dirk must navigate the room safely to avoid their crushing embrace. The Misty Room, or Snake Room, has our brave knight trying to find a way out of a sealed chamber, before he falls victim to the numerous snakes that descend from the ceiling. With the Cauldron Room, or the Wizard's Chamber, as it's also known, it finds Dirk combating magical monsters that bubble up from the cauldron in the center of the room. The room known as Flattening Stairs describes exactly the first trap you need to avoid in this room, though there are some purple tentacles to contend with as well. My second favorite room is the Giddy Goons, and you must help Dirk navigate the spiral staircase while fighting off the furry and maniacal gibbering goons, who are quite ready to plunge their sharp daggers into his back, or, worse yet, eat our hero alive. The Fire Room is just as described. A magical fire breaks out in the small room, and Dirk must find a way out. The Pool of Water, and its mirrored version, is one of the toughest scenes in the game, at least for me. Dirk must avoid falling to his death as the floor beneath his feet crumbles, roll out of harm's way from a wall trap that shoots scimitars, survive the snake-infested pool, slay a large spider, and then escape the room before he's crushed by a floor trap. The catwalk challenges Dirk with surviving not just the disintegration of said catwalk, but pesky bats who want him to lose balance and fall to his death. The Checkered Floor Room, which has a mirrored version, is another room that to this day still causes me grief. Dirk must face the Black Knight again, this time avoiding the deadly electrical arcs that travel across the checkered floor, until he must face the Black Knight itself. The Bat Room has Dirk escaping those pesky bats again, before being confronted by a giant version that is barring his escape. The Throne Room finds Dirk's sword and helm being snatched by a crystal ball in the middle of the room. When he attempts to retrieve them, electrical energy... There sure is a lot of electrical traps in this game, right? Electrical energy forces our knight to find the secret exit. Then there is the Mudmen Room. Finding his sword of little use, Dirk must escape through the mud pits, with its erupting geysers, and avoid the grasps of the Mudmen themselves. Finally, there is the Dragon's Lair. Dirk must attempt to secure a key from around the dragon's neck, to free Princess Daphne, who is held in a massive crystal ball. This would be made easier if the dragon wasn't trying to crush and roast our hero. It takes split-second timing to help Dirk overcome the rampaging beast and win Daphne's freedom. I'm pretty sure back in the day, and even now, most people aren't worried about score when playing Dragon's Lair. But there are indeed points awarded for each interaction in the rooms. The high score holder at the Arcadia Retrocade, and first player to beat the game, was Robert Brown, who obtained 2,147,442 points. But that was on constant play, without losing any of his 3 lives. He was good enough to reach the end over and over again in a single afternoon, and Shay just added all of his points up. The official world record holder, verified by a Twin Galaxies referee, was Greg R. Sekundiak, who earned 374,954 points back on July 20th, 1985. Now, a game as popular as Dragon's Lair naturally found itself being ported to all manner of home computers of the day, as well as continuing to be released to current next-generation technology. It might be easier to tell you what game system it didn't have a release for, and that was the Sega Genesis, although it was available on the Sega CD.
Arcadia will be right back after these messages.
The most advanced video game you can play is awaiting your discovery at Showbiz Pizza Place. The princess is held captive, and only the brave knight, Dirk the Daring, can save her. With sophisticated laser disc animation, you'll move Dirk through the innumerable dangers of the enchanted castle to rescue the beautiful princess. Dragon's Lair, the supreme adventure in video games, brand new at Showbiz Pizza Place.
Tomorrow, it's a Super Saturday of great fun and adventure with Turbo Teen and the Dragon's Lair. Then,
Merry Christmas, everyone!
Catch the Yuletide spirit with Scooby-Doo as he cooks up a batch of holiday surprises. Then, tomorrow night at 8, 7 Central, a family of misfits takes over the church play and act out an all-new Christmas story. Loretta Swit stars in the best Christmas pageant ever. Tomorrow, your Saturday morning favorites and the best Christmas pageant ever.
Now, as you heard from that ABC TV commercial, Dragon's Lair was developed into an animated series by Ruby Spears. Dirk the Daring was voiced by Bob Sarlate. Clive Revel, who was the voice of the Emperor in the original release of The Empire Strikes Back, provided his voice as the storyteller, the narrator of the show, if you will. The evil dragon earned a name in the series. Appropriately enough, it was Singe, and he was voiced by Arthur Burghardt. Ellen Gertzel provided her voice talent as Princess Daphne, who was now very much a sidekick to Dirk. Our hero also found himself with a squire named Timothy, who was voiced by Michael Mish. Dirk also had a loyal horse named Bertram, whose animal sounds were provided by the legendary Peter Cullen, who also provided the voice of Dirk's rival for Princess Daphne's affections in the show, as Sir Hubert Blunt. Daphne's father, King Ethelred, was voiced by the late, great Fred Travellina. Beginning its run on September 8, 1984, and running until April 27 of 1985, the show sadly only had 13 episodes, but they generally featured villains and locations from the game itself, like the Lizard King, the Giddy Goons, and the Mudmen. It also had a very novel approach to its commercial breaks, with Dirk and his friends being faced with a deadly dilemma, and the storyteller asking, "What would you do in this situation?"
There goes our sneak attack!
Out of my way, beasts! He didn't really mean beasts.
Dirk, the door is closing! Gelda will be trapped!
There are too many Shadmoks, and the vault door's nearly closed!
Should Dirk fight the fierce Shadmoks, or should he try to save Gelda before the iron door closes, locking her in forever? Is there enough time for Dirk to do both? What would you do? Which way did you choose? If Dirk had fought the Shadmoks, he'd have lost his chance to get inside the chamber.
Oh, no!
Fortunately, Dirk had the help of his loyal friends.
Tally-ho! Quick! These poisonous toadstools will keep them away!
Now, many times the solution to the confrontation or peril wasn't made very clear, but I can assure you that didn't stop me from constantly shouting out over breakfast what I thought Dirk should do. Dragon's Lair found itself being merchandised to coloring and storybooks, a read-along book with a cassette tape from Telestory, Fleer trading cards that offered not only stickers featuring the animation from the game, but scratch cards where you tried to get Dirk safely through a maze. Dragon's Lair had birthday party supplies like invitations and napkins, a board game, buttons and flip books, and a beautiful Aladdin lunchbox. Dragon's Lair was primed for a sequel after Space Ace, but fans of the series would have to wait 8 years before they were reunited with Dirk the Daring and Daphne in Dragon's Lair 2, Time Warp. But I think that is the subject of another podcast. Here at the Arcadia Retrocade, Dragon's Lair shares a spot right next to Space Ace. They were added to the arcade about half a year after Arcadia had opened its doors to the public. Shay Mathis called me one morning after I was finishing up my night audit shift at the hotel I work at and asked if I could drop by the arcade before going home. Well, to be honest, I had just finished an 18-hour shift and couldn't find the energy, but promised I would stop by before work later that day. I walked into the arcade, and as I stepped into the door, the attract mode for both it and Space Ace began. Friends, I have this habit of getting so excited sometimes that I forget to breathe, and that is exactly what happened in this case. While it was horrible to have to drag myself away from Dragon's Lair without playing it, I had to get to work. Still, it made the next 18-hour shift more manageable knowing Arcadia had both Dragon's Lair and Space Ace in its collection. As you might imagine, it took a bit of getting used to for new players to wrap their heads around the gameplay, but I'm glad to say that just like for those of us that grew up with the game, the animation kept players coming back again and again, and this time it didn't cost them 50 cents a pop. Now, last week I received a wonderful email by Chris K, who said, quote, "Love your diary podcast series. It brings back a lot of memories for me, an arcade junkie like yourself. I have a question about the high scores at the arcade you work at. Every podcast, you list the high score at your arcade for the particular game you're talking about. Do you guys keep the games plugged in 24/7 to preserve the scores?" End quote. Thanks for the praise, Chris. The answer to your question about the high score depends on the machines themselves. I mean, we do cut the power to the arcade at the end of the night, but some of the machines are lucky enough to have their high scores retained thanks to a battery pack, like William's Sinistar, which needs only two AA batteries to keep the scores intact from day to day. Some games, like, say, Pac-Man, well, those aren't saved, I'm afraid to report, but that is why we are sure to write down in the log any time a new high score is reached. We jot down the record breaker as well as the full name of the player who achieved the score. I think that about wraps up our show for this go-around. But I would like to remind everyone listening that on Wednesday nights, I generally have a live feed at the Arcadia Retrocade. You can find the feed on YouNow. That's YOUNOW. And find me by searching for my Twitter handle, which is VicSage2005. There's no set amount of time for each feed, but I usually do it a couple times a night, taking my tablet through the arcade, talking to the players, and letting you see and hear those classic games. So I hope you'll join us for the next Diary of an Arcade Employee vidcast this Wednesday. Our wonderful ending theme entitled River Raid was composed by the extremely talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Friends, if you have any feedback for the show or perhaps a suggestion for a game to cover, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. Diary of an Arcade Employee is now available for download on iTunes, so if you have a moment, really would appreciate it if you could stop by there and give us a positive review. It really helps us to get the word out to new listeners. For further information about the Arcadia Retrocade, please make sure to follow them over on their Facebook page. I will be sure to provide a link on the Retroist post. Of course, I want to give a huge thanks to the Retroist for not just hosting this podcast, but for allowing me to record in the Retroist vault. And when you need your daily retro fix, why not visit the Retroist site at www.retroist.com. Have a token on me as we listen to a clip for the game I will discuss on the next show. This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye, and we hope to see you next time.